podcast this week, we extend the invite to the Infight director and stars, Olivia Wilde and Edward Norton. Will they accept? Will they RSVP? I am on tenterhooks. Plus, the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast. That is relieved to hear that Dominions did not work with or for Hitler in any capacity. Great news. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I'm joined in the pod booth by what should be one, two, three colleagues of such lethal cunning. But due to the train system in this country, we are working with two colleagues of such lethal cunning at the moment. But we expect the Mad Titan of Movies, James Dyer, to barrel through the door at any point over the next, what, hour?
Sure.
Or so. People who are here, people who made the effort and showed up on time. Geek Queen Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. Good. And Alex Godfrey is here. Alex, you still don't have a thing that I introduce you as.
Well, I don't invent it myself. That seems egotistical.
It needs to be organic, right?
I have an idea.
Okay.
I went to get some lunch from Pret on the way here.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. So he's Pret the podcast because he's always ready to pod.
Do you know what Pret called the gingerbread man? Godfrey.
Do they?
They do.
And he could be...
He's a gingerbread man?
The gingerbread man.
Well, that's exciting. There's a Godfrey, and then there's a female one. Like, they look the same to me. But yeah. The female ones are called Annie. Right.
Annie?
Yeah. Mm. And whenever I see it, just hear... How's Annie? They both look a bit disheveled. One eye is always droopy. and I always bite my own head off.
Hey, Alex, are you happy with the gingerbread man as a nickname?
I don't think it's very good.
No. We'll workshop it. We workshopped James's and we came up with ultimately the Mad Titan of Movies.
Yeah.
If you have any suggestions for Alex's nickname, then do send them in.
It took about 10 years to get James's nickname down.
Yeah, it did.
So
it
did. I won't.
Yeah.
There's no hurry.
How do you feel about this Minions news, that this has been confirmed? Because people have been wondering, because obviously the Minions are drawn towards like evil... evil people. And so there's always been speculation for years that they would indeed have sided with the Nazis in World War II. But the director of the new Minions and Monsters movie, Pierre Coffin, who, in fact, and speaking of evil dictators...
Oh, my God.
Hello.
Oh.
That is the bell that sounds whenever I enter a room.
That's the bell end that
the
sounds whenever James
enters a room.
It is the chime of James.
The clanging chimes of doom. Well, tonight, thank God, it's Lem instead of you. Hello, James.
Hi, Chris.
We're talking about the Minions working for Hitler, or not in this case.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because Pierre Coffin has confirmed, the director and indeed voice of the Minions, has confirmed that they did not work for Hitler because they were frozen in a cave.
They were.
Now, this is worrying because it implies that they would have worked for
yes.
Hitler
had they been available. So it was really a scheduling issue.
He needed to get out. For anyone who actually reads Empire magazine, we had a Minions feature in our last issue, which was on sale, I don't know, 4 weeks ago. We did ask him about it. Because there has been online speculation for a while, like, would they have worked for Hitler? I don't know why everyone is so desperate to know the answer to that ridiculous question.
I think they want to cancel the Minions.
It would be hilarious if the answer was no, because they were busy working for Stalin.
Yeah.
yes. I mean, they could spread themselves around the dictators,
that's
couldn't
true,
they?
That's
whoever
true.
Wins, we lose. So we did ask him, and he actually gave us a much more considered answer about that question. And he said, listen, these are Minions movies. I'm not doing hardcore politics. We're not getting into that. He actually said, I'm not going after Hitler.
if anyone deserves to be gone after, it's Hitler, I would say.
I think what he was basically saying, there is no room for fascist content in Minions movies. And now he's been pushed on it because people want their content. And he's like, they were frozen in a cave, whatever.
All right. Yeah. Okay, so they did not work for Hitler. What I'm keen to know is if there's any truth to the rumors that they're behind the hydration breaks at the World Cup. Anyway, that's
that's very funny.
That's one for the people in the room here. So anyway, shall we move on?
Jimbo? Let's have a hydration break.
Yeah, I think Jimbo needs a hydration break.
I am hydrating actually as we speak, so that's good.
Yeah, you are. What was your excuse? What happened?
Well, the trains were I believe the technical term according to the rail line was fucked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That tends to be the case. In this country.
Yeah, it took a while. There were many tunnels. There were many stretches of sitting on the tracks.
To quote the air stewardess in Die Hard 2, mere minutes before she suffers a fiery doom along with
British
hundreds
rail,
of
love.
Well, was it? We may be late, but we'll get you there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. They did get me here. Unfortunately for all of you, I am
Colonel Stewart.
Yes. Colonel Stewart. Although wearing significantly more clothes despite the the temperature.
You were inevitable.
Have you ever done a naked jujitsu in a hotel room?
Haven't we all?
Like Colonel Stewart in Die Hard 2?
No.
I mean, it's more Tai Chi, isn't it, really?
Is it Tai Chi?
It's kind of Tai Chi. Yes.
See, that's disappointing.
Why? Tai Chi is a martial art.
I know, but it's also one about spiritual healing. It's about spiritual healing. And Colonel Stewart is not a man who I think is
spiritually healed.
Well, yes, I don't think he has leanings in the spiritual healing or indeed sexual healing.
No, but he has immaculately chiseled buttocks.
He does. So. And in the odd shot, you can see the outline of his testicles.
Oh, why? Never mind.
You have to pause it at exactly the right time, Helen.
Yeah. How do you? Never mind. I don't want to know what led to this.
We'll give you the time code.
No, it's okay.
Okay.
Funnily enough, he calls his penis the Colonel.
Yeah. He did not die hard.
No.
Funnily enough.
Oh, boy.
Died flaccid.
Yeah. Oh, come on.
Just in case that wasn't clear.
No, we got it. We got it. Yeah.
I think the Minions would work with James. What do you think?
I don't
know. They do already.
I think they'd be frozen in a cave otherwise.
Oh, dear. So. Despicable Dire. All right. Before we get into this week's listener question, a couple of things. Thank you so much for the kind words and overwhelmingly positive feedback to the launch of Empire Plus last week. It really, really made our hearts sing to see so many of you being very, very happy about that. If you don't know what Empire Plus is, it's our paywall offering. It's our subscriber channel. And it used to be just the Empire Supporter Specials. And now it is the Empire Supporter Specials plus more besides. You will get ad-free versions of this very podcast and things like the interviews and the shameless plug. They will be behind the paywall because we know that some people really cannot stand the adverts. You're also going to get some new shows as well, monthly episodes of The Ranking, monthly episodes of a new Mount Rushmore show, which we're recording later on this afternoon, the first one of Lowe's. It's all very, very exciting indeed. And you can, where can people subscribe to this, Jimbo, if they don't already?
If they don't already, then they can go to empire.supportingcast.fm. But if they do already subscribe, then have to do anything because it naturally, like Spoiler Specials, evolves into Empire Plus without any intervention.
Yes.
And crucially, this now means you only need one feed. So it's like your one you can eat feed. Empire feed, one feed to rule them all. It's like Pilot
and
Plus,
in the darkness,
but not quite as good.
Them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wait, except what? What?
Hey, what?
Hang on a second.
But almost as good. Almost.
Why can't you be frozen in a cave? Why couldn't that have happened? But you can also, there's a Pilot and Empire bundle, which will be available from July 27th. Yeah. Get on it, get in it, get inside it, get around it, look at it, walk around it. It's going to be absolutely incredible, wonderful content poured into your ears over the next few months and years until we're 90. So that's going to be a lot of fun. And speaking of content, we are doing another live show, folks. Yes, indeedy. We are doing another live show every year. Like Brigadoon, we appear out of nowhere and we do a live show at the at King's Place in London, our spiritual home in London, for the London Podcast Festival, which is like the Glastonbury of podcasts. And once again, we've been given a primo Saturday night headline slot, Saturday, September 5th at King's Place, London. Yeah. That is just about 2 months away. Tickets are on sale right now. It's going to be amazing. It's going to be us banging on about movies in the usual style, plus a special guest that I totally have locked down. But I've got 2 months. I've got 2 months to find someone to do that. So go to kingsplace.co.uk to get tickets for that. All right. So I've got a couple of questions this week. People sent them in on Instagram. Here's an interesting one. This comes from someone simply called Uh-Oh on Instagram.
It's a minion. That's a good sign.
It may well be a minion. I'm not sure. It might be Kevin or Stuart or Bob. I'm not sure.
Is it about bananas?
It's not about bananas. Can you hum or whistle Oh?
I mean, I can.
I can't read this out.
Is that the whole question?
I can't read this out. Oh. I've got to do this and you guys have got to guess what I'm doing.
Okay. Right.
Because can you hum and whistle the following movie themes in this order? And then there's three movie themes.
You know how to whistle, don't you?
Yes.
That's correct.
Don't let the person know the next theme until they have completed the previous one. Oh, okay. So I think I give this to someone and then I see if they can hum this theme.
Uh-huh.
The problem here is that Uh-Oh has chosen three of the most famous movie themes in the history of cinema.
Right.
So I think we'll be able to nail this. Uh-oh, says, not a single person I've asked to do this has been able to do it. Although, to be fair, my friends are not professional film nerds and not smart. Well, we're not smart, but we are professional film nerds. So I think we'll be able to do this. I'm going to go round the table because there's three of you.
Can we expand the orchestra? Are we saying whistle, hums, mouth trumpet?
What's the, you know what? Don't tell me.
As long as it's mouth trumpet and not trouser trumpet, then we're good with that. Although if you can control your farts,
go for it.
Let's not go there.
All right. So Helen, I'm going to ask you to hum or whistle the first theme. Alex, I'm going to ask you to hum or whistle the second theme, which I will not give you until Helen has finished humming and whistling the first theme. I want you to do it immediately. No thinking about it, all right? You go straight into it, and James, you will get the third theme.
Okay.
Okay? I'm not doing this because I would just nail it.
I think I know what this is going to be, actually.
Do you?
I think I do.
All right. Helen, can you hum or whistle the theme to Star Wars?
Yeah, I knew it was going to be these ones. I knew it.
You're buying time. You're buying time.
Well, okay, but crucially, Which one? Are we talking the main title theme?
Star Wars. In your own time. Is it possible we started in the wrong key? Okay. Alex, Superman.
See, I knew that was going to be it.
Oh, good. I didn't think you'd get that.
Wow, well, that's right. Very good.
I changed the mode of whistling.
Mm. Yes. Wise.
All right. James, Indiana Jones. See? Nailed it. Piece of piss.
Oh, I can't get that high. Sorry. It's gone.
Human kazoo.
I know what you mean. You know, if you have Star Wars in your head and you go straight into Superman, you can trip up. It's hard. A thing that happens. Genuinely.
Because I have found this since childhood. Whenever someone said, sing the Superman theme, I would start and it would become Star Wars after a few
would
bars.
It
can, possibly
it can
because John Williams
if,
is a hack. That may be the reason.
How?
How dare you? Get out.
But I'm just saying, like trying to say, someone says, right, do the theme tune to Predator and then go straight into Back to the Future. And you're like, oh my God, Sylvester Stallone sounds the same.
Can I just point you to the needle point on the wall that says, in this house, we love and respect John Williams?
Oh, and brackets, fair. It says, even the Home Alone score. Close
yes,
brackets.
It's a good score.
The only good score in that movie is when the wet bandits try and rip off that mob house.
Oh.
That's the only good score in that movie.
John Williams is not a hack. Honestly.
Disrespectful.
Unfounded.
Yeah.
That was a drive-by. It was an unexpected drive-by. This 90-something-year-old man.
No one
is
safe.
This legend, the greatest composer in the history of movies. And you come in.
That's right.
With your fucking Gru energy.
Yeah. The last thing anyone ever said about him on air was, what a hack.
Yeah. Wow.
What a hack.
That would be a terrible
45
imagery.
cc's of pure Johnny Williams adrenaline. All right. I'm going to say to I'm going to give you a challenge. Come back next week with three different movies. Slightly harder. I will say I'm not here next week, so maybe come back in 2 weeks' time when I am back, and come back with three movies that have different themes, and we'll nail it. We'll nail it. I'll make sure it's movies we know, but not this easy.
This was a trick.
A notch up.
This wasn't do you know them. This is can you untangle them in your brains?
Of course you can.
Mm.
It's easy.
Well, we managed it, but frankly,
Superman, Indiana Jones, Indiana Jones, easy,
perfect,
All right, here's one. It is a very, very sad one on the surface, but I'm hoping that we can salvage something from this question. This comes from Sam Garrett 7 on Instagram. I've just been made redundant due to AI. Bastards. Very, very sad to hear that, Sam. Fuck AI. Hashtag fuck AI. Any life affirming, can't spell life affirming without AI. Redundancy films
no.
to what? too soon? Any life affirming redundancy films to emulate. So films in which people have been fired,
yes.
laid off, given the old P45, the old heave ho, but then they've turned it into a moment of triumph. James, you have one immediately.
I do have one. Obviously, I could just drop Jerry Maguire and walk away, but I'm actually not going to. I'm instead going to go slightly off-piste, as is my wont, and say Lee Child. Lee Child, who got made redundant from his job in TV. And hang on, there are films in his future, bear with me. And with his redundancy money, he sat down with a pencil and a pad and wrote Killing Floor, the first Jack Reacher
book. Wait a minute, James, you might actually be onto something here.
And made lots of money and films and TV shows and stuff and minted, you know, cash.
Because Reacher has been made redundant.
That's true. Reacher himself was indeed made redundant.
Didn't he just retire?
No, he's kicked out of the army.
He was downsized out of the army. When they reduced force readiness, he lost his job. So he didn't voluntarily leave the army.
Oh,
oh my God.
So he was made redundant. And he then managed a lucrative career punching people in the face and hitting them with scything elbows.
Just walking from town to town.
Yeah.
Putting right what once went wrong.
That's right.
And hoping each time that he'd get a piece of peach pie.
Yeah.
Making love to the beautiful ladies, punching the ugly men, triangulating how far a yogurt pot will fly.
Having two very specific types of shower.
Oh, three.
Visiting boots whenever possible.
How life-affirming.
Oh, God. What an amazing... Yes, so there you go. Jack Reacher. Yeah. That's your North Star. He will light your way. Right. Hells bells?
I was going to say Baby Boom at the other end of the sort of spectrum. I'm sorry, but
that's
like,
the one with Diane Keaton and not the one with Cary Grant and the little leopard.
Correct. That's Bringing Up Baby.
Bringing Up Baby.
Baby
and not
Boom.
The one with Tom Selleck and Ted Danson as Steve Guttenberg.
Three Men and a Baby, which I actually also have a lot of time for. No, Baby Boom is the one where Diane Keaton basically inherits her niece when her sister and brother-in-law are killed in a car accident.
Oh my God.
So she's left with this baby and she's like this hard-nosed career woman who's like engaged to Grandpa Gilmore and has this whole life going on. And then she basically loses her job because she has a baby and it's the 80s and has to move to the countryside and basically starts making sort of like stewed apple baby food.
Right.
And then makes a career out of that and starts dating a dishy vet. So
a dishy vet?
A dishy vet. I think it was it Sam Shepard? I think it might have been Sam Shepard. Anyway, he was dishy. The point is, there's quite a lot of films like this, I feel like, in the sort of like inspirational woman starting her life over kind of mode. But Baby Boom, for some reason, is the one that came to my head. I apologize.
Yeah. All right. Baby Boom.
I don't know.
Alex, do you have a life-affirming redundancy film?
Well, yeah, I was going to say Full Monty, because that starts off with... aren't they all redundant?
They've all been laid off.
Because of the steel industry situation at that time. And they turn their fortunes on their heads by getting their willies out.
They swap steel for wood.
I don't know if they have wood.
Yeah, I don't think
that was
Well, you can't say, because we never actually see.
No.
Well, you can, because like there would be consequences. Like it would be, there would be, you know, there are laws, conventions.
Yes, now
there are laws.
Really? In working men's clubs?
And that's what I call a happy ending. But also, James, sorry to take you up on it, but I believe, if memory serves, Jerry Maguire was not made redundant. He was fired on the spot for writing provocative mission statements.
I mean...
Was he
fired for cause?
Idealistic.
Like, it feels like, yes,
that's
he's
not redundancy.
Not for cause.
That's, we don't want any of that. Get out.
Yeah, because I'm not saying that's really a sackable offence, is it?
I think we're somewhat conflating firing and redundancy, because most redundancies aren't technically redundancies.
No.
So it's kind of a grey area.
It's all the same.
It's all the same.
Yeah, people lose their jobs.
Yeah, the point is that you have to start something over. And it can be good for you, in my experience.
Yeah.
But it's still not a fun thing to go through. So
pivot wildly and do something completely different. Do a Taylor Sheridan, and instead of being paid very little to act, just dominate the whole of the entertainment industry by writing stuff, even though you've never done it before.
Yeah, that's great advice. Just dominate.
Just
the whole
do that. Just dominate the entire entertainment industry.
When Jack Reacher was let go from the army, he pivoted to dominate the field of punching ugly people in the face.
You know,
Not just ugly people. He's an equal opportunities puncher.
Mm. He will punch attractive people
in
the face as well.
He will.
Yeah.
When called upon to do so.
Mm. Yeah. That's exciting. All right, I'm going to throw one into the mix. Ghostbusters.
Oh, great.
Because those guys get let go university at the beginning of the movie because of their shenanigans, and they don't have a pot to piss in. This magnificent feast represents the last of the petty cash, etc., etc., etc. But they club together. They somehow buy that firehouse, and you know, an old hearse, and they end up saving the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, Sam,
these are all very positive.
I think so
for Sam,
but we don't want negative stories, James.
I think we should give opportunities. I think we should give a spread of possibilities, options. So I'm saying falling down is maybe a way to go.
Oh no, it is not.
It's not life affirming.
I'm sure it's quite cathartic.
Well, it depends which character you're thinking about. If you watch that film and you focus on the Robert Duvall character, then it is quite life affirming. Because he ends up taking control of his life again.
He does.
He doesn't quit the force, and he tells his wife, who's, you know, very, very controlling, to basically go, you know, do one. And he tells his boss, he says, fuck you very much to his boss, and doesn't suffer any repercussions for that. And he decides to carry on as a cop. If you look at it from the viewpoint of defense, played by Michael Douglas, not so much in the life-affirming category.
No, I wouldn't say life-affirming in that case, no. And there's a lot of bad comedies about this, like The Internship.
Yeah.
Was that
the Anne Hathaway?
With Robert De Niro.
The Robert De Niro one.
That's the intern.
The internship
is Vince Vaughn.
Vince Vaughn, Owen Wilson.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
Yeah, which I was thinking of, where they get internships basically at Google and have to compete with young people.
Was it a tough search?
It kind of is, because they're very bad at their jobs and don't understand anything that's going on and are like total dreamers about the whole thing.
Exactly. They fit in so well here.
Come and work a vampire.
Yes, they could. So there we go. That's very exciting. Well done, everybody. I enjoyed that. And Sam, it sucks. I too know the pain that you are feeling right now. All I can say is that it will get better, and hopefully these life-affirming films, watch them as a quadruple bill, but maybe leave out Falling Down. So watch the first Jack Reacher for some reason.
Yeah.
We're watching Jack Reacher. We're watching The Full Monty. We're watching Baby Boom. What the fuck? And we're finishing off with Ghostbusters.
Yeah,
so,
if made redundant, you could get your willy out with your friends or hunt some ghosts.
Or stew some apples.
Those are your three options.
Or fall in love with Sam Shepard.
Yeah, I think at least three of those things are the same thing, but that's okay.
Oh, and Jerry Maguire. Stick it on top as well.
Okay.
Why not?
Yeah. Yeah.
Dorothy Boyd, thank you.
You
had
me
at, etc.
You had me at below.
Hey. All right. So that's it for the questions this week. If you want to get in touch with me, I am mainly soliciting questions on Instagram these days. I'm CTAH1976. He has the trips off the tongue. Look out for a panicked shout out every now and again, or slide into my DMs. Right. Okay. We're going to take a little break. Now, if you're listening to this not on Empire Plus, you might hear some adverts. If you listen to this on Empire Plus, you'll hear no adverts. And the next thing you'll hear will be me. Anyway, shall we talk about some movie news?
Hurrah.
Let's do it. Is there any, first of all? And what is it?
I feel like we should probably talk about the Werewolf trailer.
Werewolf.
Yes.
Werewolf.
Robert Eggers is back. He's made his film again.
Now, hang on.
And this time the accents are once again exciting.
I mean, yeah, but isn't that what you want from him? I mean, if he comes up with, you know, he says, I've done a rom-com.
I would
pay...
absolutely watch
that. Yeah, 100%.
Oh my God.
I would pay real money to see Robert Eggers
do
a rom-com.
Yes, you're saying that because you want it to be a Robert Eggers version of a rom-com in which everything is horrible.
I mean, Nosferatu was kind of a rom-com.
In some ways.
It wasn't
in some ways.
All.
You heard me at hello.
I really want
talking
to
of the
that.
Full Monty.
Hey.
You can leave your head on.
Werewolf, people say werewolf.
Werewolf.
Nobody knows if it's
we don't know, but
actually
it's much more fun to
we
say.
Have to say werewolf.
Werewolf.
Yes.
It looks great. Great trailer. We spoke to him for the website.
Well, you specifically.
I know. I was being, you know, generous.
Coy, yeah.
It's a teaser trailer. I think they call these things teasers anyway. It's a 2-minute trailer.
Yeah, it's a trailer.
And it's very good. It's set in the early 1300s. It stars Aaron Taylor-Johnson about a man who's having some issues and is clearly going to become a werewolf. Lily Rose Depp plays his wife, who is trying to help him out. And Willem Dafoe plays some sort of wolf hunter or werewolf. Hunter. And it's just very Robert Eggers. Mm. It looks like the witch. Sorry, the Vvitch. Vvitch. It looks like the lighthouse. It looks a bit like Nosferatu. His, you know,
it has Willem Dafoe in it.
Yeah, every film is sort of like, this is everything I've done before, but more. And then again and again and again and again. It just looks really, really good. It looks beautiful. It looks horrible. It looks intense. It looks quite scary. It looks really mucky. Mm. I think he's just going to go all out with Werewolf Madness. I mean, it's a 2-minute trailer. It doesn't give too much away, but it features people that look very unwell. And I think we have faith in Robert Eggers that if he's doing a werewolf movie, then
we do.
If nothing else, it's going to look and feel and sound incredible and probably very, very authentic, hopefully with a great story and good performance as well. I think hopefully Aaron Taylor-Johnson is going to pull it out of the bag for this. I mean, when I spoke to Eggers about it, I asked him why he chose him for it. Obviously, they just worked together on Nosferatu. But he said, Aaron Taylor-Johnson used to be a dancer. He's got a dance background, and this is a really, really physical role. Mm. And he's hooked him up with the movement coach who worked with Lily Rose Depp on Nosferatu, and she did some amazing work. So I think it's going to be very physical, very tactile movie.
You get a hint of transformation in this, don't you? I don't know whether it's going to be like a full-blown Rick Baker, Rob Bottin style prosthetics all over the shop transformation, or whether it's going to be more allegorical. Who knows? But there's certainly hints that he's got fangs and
he's foaming at the mouth. Yeah. He's bone cracking, which obviously does bring to mind American Werewolf in London.
Mm. Yes.
But that's, that's the awesome. Rob Eggers says that. He said, interestingly, the best werewolf movie is a comedy. Which is true. I mean, there is nothing else.
Teen Wolf. Do you think that's what he meant?
He meant Teen Wolf 2, actually.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's fair.
Jason Bateman's finest moment on the big screen.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
I'm hyped. And I think, is he leaning into the kind of rabies angle then with the foaming mouth and stuff like that, do you think?
I mean, there were a lot of diseases around at that time.
Yeah,
wasn't not many vaccines. Like I say, there's a lot of unwell-looking people in the trailer. And I'm sure, medical experts weren't around to help too much. But I don't know much more, but it just looks really cool. It's working with Jaron Blaschke, the same cinematographer he's always worked with, and they make these beautiful, there are some really gorgeous shots in this film. Mm.
That's exciting. Very exciting. More excited by the sequel, Fairy Fools 2, with Jason Bateman. That's going to be amazing. There was another horror/comedy sequel trailer out this week. Hellspells, did you watch Practical Magic 2?
Yes. I mean, look, I'm in the bag for this. I don't really care about the trailers, but I watched it anyway. And this is the return of Sandra Bullock and Nicole Kidman as the cursed, but also, witchcraft rich sisters who, it's a whole family thing. Basically, they've got daughters, or Sandra Bullock does technically. They also have aunts. It's three generations of witchy women who have to work together to break the curse that's still lingering around, despite the fact that they thought it was broken in the last film. Turns out, not so much.
No.
Lee Pace is involved. Someone tells him to put his clothes up. They're relieved that he has his clothes on. I did trip over that line in the trailer, I'll be honest. But it's basically trying to save the younger generation this time from the family curse, which means that every man who loves them dies.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously better than the women dying, but it's, it's still not great.
I love Sandra Bullock. Does this mean I'm going to die?
It means you are in line for certain sudden death. Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Sorry about that. Yeah.
Oh, well. I do it gladly.
It's worth
anything
it.
For Sandy. It's the first movie. It's interesting because it was a decent-sized hit, I think.
Yeah.
But it seems to become a bit of a beloved cult classic over the years.
Yeah, I think
fair
it's
to say.
I think again, the cult is this tiny minority group called women.
tell me more.
Yeah.
I'm interested.
I think it's one of those films that keeps coming up again and again. Obviously, like Christmas movies, this is put on Netflix or equivalent every Halloween, and people watch it again every Halloween or whatever. It's a very hot autumnal movie. This one seems to lean into the same colors, even though it was shot here in the UK. They've, recreated the sort of the house set of the original one.
Right.
And it's just quite cozy, despite there being a little bit of a thriller element.
Okay. First one was directed by Griffin Dunne, and this one's directed by Suzanne Beer.
Yeah.
Hold my beer.
Proper directors,
proper directors.
Mm-hmm. And they've got kind of the gang back together in terms of you've got Stockard, Channing, and Diane Veist in there as well. So it's, It's proper.
That's very exciting.
Oh, aye.
Very exciting indeed about the old Practical Magic 2. There's another trailer you wanted to talk about, wasn't there?
Yeah, Sense and Sensibility.
If you have any Sense and Sensibility. Yeah,
there we go. 2026 version is out. I mean, look, this is, let's be honest, treading in the footsteps of giants, because the Ang Lee, Emma Thompson, Kate Winslet version is beloved, canonical, even though it's a fairly loose adaptation at points. It was an Oscar-winning hit. It is fantastic. Now we have Georgia Oakley stepping into those hallowed shoes with Daisy Edgar-Jones, Katrina Balfe, Esme Creed-Miles in the sort of key roles. It looks quite painterly and nice. They seem to have a good grasp on the characters. It's hard to tell yet what kind of an adaptation it's going to be, if it's going to be, you know, if they're going to lean into the fidelity, what they're going to do to kind of make themselves stand apart. But it certainly looks like a Sense and Sensibility film. So, it, you know, well done, everybody.
It's going to be a tough one to follow up, right? The Ang Lee movie?
Very, I mean, it's seriously beloved. And it is a great, great Austen adaptation. It's funny, it's smart, it's beautifully paced, incredibly well acted. It was a big breakthrough role for Kate Winslet. Obviously won Emma Thompson an Oscar for the adaptation itself. It is a fantastic film. So, you know, I am wary of this in that sense, but at the same time, it has been 30 years. Maybe it's okay if somebody else has a crack at it, I guess.
Jimbo, are you excited about this, or do you find the whole thing exhausting?
Oh, I see what you did there.
Oh, no.
Yeah. No, I am, I mean, excited might be overstating it, but I'm quite looking forward to seeing it. So, yeah, like I have not seen Ang Lee's Sense and Sensibility since I think Austen wrote the book. So it's been some time. So I feel, I will feel like I'm going in fresh because I literally don't remember anything that happens.
Yeah.
So yeah, I know, I'm looking forward to it. I like Daisy Edgar Jones. Yeah, I think it's going to be good.
That's exciting. Alex?
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah. All right.
He's more of an Emma man himself.
Yes. Some other news very, very quickly. So Parker Finn, the director of Smile and Smile 2, is remaking the incredible 1981 horror film Possession, which starred Sam Neill and Isabella Gianni, one of the great performances in a horror film, or any film, really, by Isabella Gianni, who absolutely goes for it in that movie. And in fact, watching Smile 2 and Naomi Scott's incredible performance in that reminded me of Isabella Gianni, some of the risks that she was taking and some of the places she was going to. So in a way, it's not a surprise that Parker Finn is remaking Possession, which is about a married couple who are experiencing a cataclysm in their marriage, which may or may not be happening, and also may or may not have repercussions for humanity. And it's really, it's the kind of movie that stays with you when you see it. Paul Dano has just signed on to co-star in it, along with Callum Turner and Margaret Qualley. So that's interesting. And Monica Barbaro is going to join the new Ocean's 11 prequel, the one that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. That'll be written and directed and starring, directed by, and starring Bradley Cooper. And also has Margot Robbie and Fagner Moura in it. Now, Helen, you poo-pooed Bradley. You hated him. You launched a malicious hate campaign against him. But does this news, Monica Barbaro?
I think she's great.
Yeah.
That is, you know, an exceptionally good-looking cast, I will say. That's a handsome group of people that they assembled. So that's a good start for an Oceans movie, right?
I mean, yeah.
The tradition is you find 11 of the handsomest people in the world. Okay, at least like three of them. And then you, then you put them in a movie. So they seem to be off to a good start.
Yes. Eddie Jemison is saying, thank you very much. Thank you very much for considering me one of the handsomest people around. Cool. Yeah. Alex, excited about the new Oceans movie?
I mean, I don't love the franchise generally. I mean, again, it's good looking people having a good time together. Whether that's going to make for a good film or not, who knows? I actually think Bradley's a good choice for it. I think there's a certain energy that he could bring to it, and I think he's, you know, he's chummy with most of Hollywood. It just depends on the chemistry of that cast, really. I mean, it is a lot of brilliant actors and a lot of beautiful people, but I guess you want that ensemble to sort of fizz somehow, right?
For it to be a prequel,
One
would think that you would have to have an Ocean involved somewhere. So is Bradley playing Danny Ocean's dad? Is Margot Robbie Danny Ocean's mum? Are they...
Maybe it'll just be on the Atlantic. I mean...
Maybe, but, you know...
Do we need that
You do intend to have, at some point, an Ocean in your Oceans movie.
That, yeah, you probably maybe. Need
it's
something.
It's not something though. I've ever... It's not like, oh, I wonder what the, you know, the mum and dad was like.
Maybe the real heist is stealing her heart.
Oh.
Two very, very quick things to talk about. Supergirl did not do well at the box office. We have been doing, a regular box office reports over the last few weeks or so. Did not do what it was even tracking to do in the States, and is not going to, unless it's a miracle, is not going to hit $100 million in the US, and will barely cover $100 million worldwide.
What do we think this means for the fledgling new DC universe that James Gunn is kind of pushing forward? Because bear in mind that this was one of the kind of fulcrums upon which he built his house. You know, like he wanted to tell this story. This was one of the big reasons why Cavill didn't come back, because they wanted to move ahead with this. Like, where do you think we go from here? Because it's hard to imagine Clayface is going to do gangbusters, even though it does look very interesting. So,
well, it's a horror film, and they're the ones that are doing gangbusters business at the moment, right?
That's correct. Yeah.
But do we think this specifically, like, because it's a horror take on a superhero movie. So
I know, but at least that sounds more interesting, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, maybe
I mean, the New Mutants tried it.
They did, but, you know, that didn't, it didn't exactly try it with conviction, I would suggest to you, because, you know, that film was buried and delayed and everything else. I think if, you know, there's potential in Clayface, especially if they kept the budget down and, you know, they can deliver something that feels fresh and new and exciting, because that does seem to be the only kind of superhero movies that are breaking out right now, right? Are the ones that feel a bit different, or maybe, presumably, Spider-Man, maybe, presumably, we hope, Avengers, but everything else has been a bit, oof. Recently, even if it's been quite good, you know. So I think it needs to feel fresh. It needs to feel different. This maybe felt a little bit too. We've seen that, even though, you know, people haven't. There hasn't been a lot of Supergirl.
I was going to say, do you think there's a gendered aspect to the reception here?
There, well, certainly the trolls online will absolutely claim that there has been. I think that they
we've won. We took her down.
Oh, I mean, which is just the dumbest and silliest and self-owningest thing, and really shows a lack of respect for comic books as an art form. If I'm honest. So yeah, I don't like to dignify them with too much credit, but I do think that there was not a lot of fan swell excitement behind this. I think that the studio didn't push it terribly hard. Mm. I think if you look at the difference between this and Superman last year, this has not had that push behind it. You know, that it hasn't had a huge advertising push. This kind of has that usual thing built in where if you give, you know, releases with women in them the same marketing budget and the same release, they actually do well, but they don't get those things. So you're not always comparing like with like, I think. Even some of the tie-ins felt a bit facile and a bit silly at times. You know, you've just got like diet drinks and stuff like that. I don't know. It just felt like they didn't have the conviction behind the movie.
But even the trailers, I mean, you watch the trailers and at best you think this looks quite fun. It seemed that a little inessential.
Disposable, maybe.
There wasn't a big sense of awe and wonder behind it. It didn't feel like an event movie.
Well, it didn't feel like it brought anything new to the table at all, did it really?
I mean, maybe then, coming straight after Superman was the wrong place for it, maybe.
Whereas, obviously, it shares a lot of Kryptonian DNA with that. Mm. But also, like, you know, we talked about this a little bit in the spoiler, especially the idea that, you know, you're forefronting a female superhero, but then I'm not entirely sure that their subject matter and their audience in their mind were the same thing. And it felt like they tried to have every possible cake and eat them and ended up with none. Whereas I think actually had they leaned into that idea of a kind of feminist empowerment story and actually catered to that audience better, maybe they would have brought people in. Who knows? Maybe not.
You asked what it means. Honestly, it's very hard to say at this point in time what it means. Comic-Con is a few weeks away. There's every chance that James Gunn and Peter Safran will take the stage in San Diego and bullishly announce their next three or four films going into 2027 past Man of Tomorrow, which is obviously filming right now and features Millie Alcock as Supergirl in that. And they'll go, you know what, we're proceeding, we're going ahead. We think that Man of Tomorrow is going to be a huge hit. People, you know, are really, really connecting with Superman after the fact. They're finding it on HBO Max or wherever. And so that'll be a bigger hit than Superman. And so this is just a bump in the road and we have faith in this character and she's going to be a big part of it going forward. And we're announcing this movie and that movie and this movie. There's also a chance that they may not do that. That's something they may be going, well, let's just wait and see what happens with Man of Tomorrow. And if Man of Tomorrow then doesn't hit, is it time for them to start rolling the whole thing up and
packing their suitcases and going home.
Well, like you say, let's see what happens with Clayface as well. Yeah. Comes I think the interesting thing about Clayface, Chris, was it you just saying just now that horror films are doing obviously big business. Mm. I'm interested to see how they market that film, because there was a teaser recently, and I don't remember it being all about DC and superheroes and comic books.
It's got the word Gotham appears in it. I mean, so you see Gotham, but
they might just market it as like a horror drama on its own terms.
It and it won't have the same marketing spend. They won't be expecting the same.
But then what was the budget for the film? Like,
I don't know off the top of my head, but I'm guessing £4.50. I honestly don't know.
About right.
30 to 50 million, yeah. Something like that. It wouldn't seem daft.
I'm very intrigued by that film. You know, Mike Flanagan wrote a draft. Did James Watkins direct it? These are good people. Yeah. They know their horror. I mean, the thing is, I'm excited about that as its own project. I don't care about
how it fits in is irrelevant. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. Mm.
So interesting to see how they wrangle it all.
So we shall see what happens with that one. Some good news. Good news, Mel Brooks made it to 100.
Happy birthday.
Hooray.
Mel Brooks.
Happy birthday to him.
Mel Brooks, the great Mel Brooks, celebrated his 100th birthday this week. And as a cause for much celebration, favorite Mel Brooks movie, Hell's Bells?
Oh, boy. I mean, I'll be honest, I'm Spaceballs. I know that's not the cool answer.
Blazing Saddles.
But I'm sorry, I know it's not the cool answer. However, that's my Mel Brooks movie. So,
all right. Jimbo says Blazing Saddles. Alex?
I loved Young Frankenstein.
Yeah.
I just loved it, especially Marty Feldman.
I think it's a tie between Young Frankenstein and Blazing Saddles for me. But yeah, if you haven't seen the Judd Apatow documentary about Mel Brooks, which is already out of date because it's called The 99-Year-Old Man, then check it out. I believe it's on Sky at the moment. So it's fantastic. 2-part documentary about his incredible life. Fought in World War II.
Yeah.
Pioneer of comedy. Oh, amazing.
Also,
amazing man.
Lest we forget, not just comedy. He produced The Elephant Man, one of the most beautiful films ever made. And was largely responsible for David Lynch being able to do what he did on that film.
What a legend. What an absolute legend. So happy birthday to Mel Brooks. I know he is an avid listener of the show.
He is.
Which leads us nicely on to New Empire Day, because it is New Empire Day as we record this. We obviously have a show called The Shameless Plug, where I sit down with Nick Dissembly and the Empire editor to talk about what's in the issue every month. So we're not going to give you the in-depth hard sell at this point, but it is a fantastic issue. It is our second issue with Chris Nolan's The Odyssey on the cover, and it is 3 covers, basically. So you can choose between Matt Damon as Odysseus. You can choose between Anne Hathaway as Penelope, or Tom Holland as Telemachus, who is Odysseus's and Penelope's son. Very exciting. Nick was on set of The Odyssey. I believe he lived in Chris Nolan's house for 10 years, hidden inside a small wooden horse, and got the inside scoop. And there's loads of other great stuff inside there as well. But go and pick it up right now. It is on sale on all good, evil, and virtual newsagents. Highly to your newsagents, please. It is a fantastic, fantastic issue. Shall we have a guest?
Let's. Yes.
Shall we have guests, in fact?
Hurrah.
Shall we have Olivia Wilde and Edward Norton? Yeah, I know. I said on last week's show I wasn't sure it was going to happen, but it is happening. Although it hasn't happened yet, because Alex is about to do it in, what, an hour or so?
Indeed, 1 hour. So let's assume everything went amazingly.
Yes. If it isn't them, if it all goes horribly wrong, then you're going to hear some Phil Lord and Chris Miller. But if not, you're going to hear Olivia Wilde and Edward Norton, who are the stars of this week's new comedy, The Infight. But Olivia Wilde is also the director of this. And it is a very, very self-contained comedy about a couple played by Olivia Wilde and Seth Rogen, who are perhaps going through a rocky patch in their marriage. And one night she invites over their upstairs neighbors, played by Penelope Cruz and Edward Norton, who are a little bit freer with her attitude towards certain things in life, shall we say, and shenanigans ensue. I adore this movie. I think it's absolutely terrific. I think you do too, Alex. We'll talk about that in the review section in just a second. And there's going to be a lot to talk about. Right. And here is Alex talking to them about it. Enjoy.
Olivia Wilde and Edward Norton, thank you so much for joining me
thank
today
you.
And letting me join you.
I'm going to get straight into it. This, I love this film so much. I'm sure you're hearing that from everybody. I found it, I don't know how much I'm going to get into this, probably not a lot, but I found it as scary as it did funny.
Good.
Right.
Yeah,
I found it, to be honest.
But let's say not in an obsession style scary, in a.
Except in box office.
In a deep emotional. Feeling you were on an emotional existential cliff, kind of scary.
Well, that's just me day to day. But yeah. No, I did. I felt like for people in long term relationships, it was, I found it like instructional, let's
Ooh,
say.
That's good.
How about
great.
Provocative?
All of the things.
Instructional.
Oh, instructional, like this is a path. There's wisdoms in this
might
for you
take,
to follow.
Take note of this. There might be some things in here that could help.
A few nuggets. Take away.
Have you had all sorts of people bearing their souls to you, having watched it and wanted to tell you about their personal lives and what the film did for them?
I have had some really vulnerable conversations with people, from strangers to friends to family. And I think that's, since production, which was the most fun I've ever had, it's been really fun to experience the kind of chemical equation of movie plus audience.
Yeah.
And it's not something you can plan for. There's alchemy there. It is always surprising. And even though the studio system tries to create a kind of math equation that will lead to a certain result, it's totally impossible and nobody knows anything. But we have had this experience where this film was one thing. Now, connecting with audiences, it's becoming something that is theirs, that is an entity in which they're plugging their projections and experiences. And it's been so interesting to hear from people who have gone with their partners or want to bring their partners people do. And I'm really proud of that. I think people think that any movie that does acknowledge that relationships are hard is inherently unromantic and sort of not something you'd want to bring a date to. And I actually think this one is making people not only kind of titillated, but actually excited to lean into relationships.
I'm intrigued to know what it was like for the four of you to get comfortable with each other. So just for people listening who don't know, there's a brilliant script written by Rashida Jones and Will McCormack. I know that you all got together for rehearsals for a couple of weeks with the writers and went through it and sort of retooled it to quite a great extent, right? Did the four of you all know each other already?
Bit.
Pretty much, yeah. Penelope and I have known each other for a long, long time. Seth and Olivia have worked together and known each other a good while.
Yeah, about 20 years.
Seth and I go at, my wife produced 40 Old Virgin and Superbad and many others with Pineapple Express with Seth. And I mean, he's kind of like in her crew. And so I've known Seth a long time. And we've made a few, I've jumped into his, Sausage Party, a very similar film to this one. Yeah.
In some ways.
There is an orgy in Sausage Party.
It is the double feature that I hoped for.
No, it's not Seth. I was going to say it's Dave Krumholtz and Salma, and I have a three-way between the taco.
Oh, wow. It is the spiritual cinematic cousin.
I guess you're just attracted to that sort of material.
Yeah, exactly. No.
I hadn't met Penelope, though. I met Penelope on Zoom in a conversation for this movie. I had met her maybe briefly socially.
Which, by the way, it was probably the perfect dynamic for you to, if there's one person for you not to have met.
Yes. I was so completely starstruck. That is exactly how Angela should feel. You're right.
She's in awe of her.
In awe. And it's funny because Penelope is such a brilliant actress that one would think that she is something like Pina based on the power she emits on screen and this incredible, there's a swagger to Pina. It's very different than the Penelope swagger. Penelope herself is very, 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 very different. And I think
she's
that
much gentler, much more recessive in sweet ways.
Yeah. Gosh. So it's, you know, I thought of her as a Pina when I wanted her to do the film. I remember her saying to me, maybe 2 days before we started filming, she came into my office and she said, I don't think I'm this, I think you think I'm already this woman, and I don't know if I am, I don't know if I have the power of Pina, if I have, and I was like, Penelope, you have to step outside yourself and see you as I see you. And I assure you, you have more than enough power for Pina. And as we've seen in the performance, she certainly did.
When you spent those 2 weeks together, like, so we've just established some of you knew each other, worked together more or less over years and years. But Olivia, you had to wrangle all of this and make something brilliant out of those sessions.
Yeah.
Were there ground rules laid down? Was it like anything goes, or was it if you don't want to talk about stuff, don't talk about it? Because I imagine you were genuinely talking about your own private thoughts and feelings and your private lives and your partners. Or were there
to a certain extent, some of us more than others, and I think it was an exercise in the best way to get at authenticity, which sometimes meant sharing a personal anecdote, but other times meant sharing an observation that felt really helpful for us in terms of a way to tell the story more clearly in a more entertaining way. But I wanted that period to be really about brainstorming together, but also just about relaxing together. We're both friends of Spike Jonze. I worked for Spike and adore him and his way of working. But I went to him before we started and I said, what do you think the best way to rehearse is? I taped out the lines of the set on the grounds of the ground of the soundstage. And I thought, you know, that'd be good. And he's like, I don't ever think that's useful. He's like, rehearsal is really just talking and relaxing and just getting rid of these barriers. And I think that's really true for us. It was getting rid of the barriers and also just finding a way to make this, to put this movie through the filter of our specific personalities.
What about you? Were you comfortable, Edward, doing talking through it all?
Yeah, because I agree. I think the intent isn't to go in and go through some, you know, Hoffman Institute like personal breakdown of everything with each other for no purpose. There's a goal, which is there's a story, there's a framework, it's the armature. We had this great framework of an original the Spanish film that it was based on that Olivia and I both loved, and then the sort of the armature of the script. And I only say that in the sense that Rashida and Will kind of transposed this great basic conceit of the two couples, but it left a lot of wide open space for Olivia to lead us into and flesh out. And she, and when you say, you talk about rules of engagement, she said from the get-go, I want to go quite a bit deeper into them individually, into their histories as couples, and illuminate this. I'll take my character, for example. It wasn't like Olivia saying, Edward, tell me the things that have happened to you that will inform Hawk. It was more a talk amongst all of us. A ton gets thrown into the sausage, you know, to the stew bowl. And then in some sense with everybody, but then Olivia with each of us, it's like, well, you know, Hawk wasn't even named Hawk. So it's a story I shared. I'll give you an example. A story I shared of a friend of mine, older friend, who in his mid-50s had a midlife crisis, not Hawk's story in the end of the day, but who changed his name from Howard to Hawk.
Yeah.
And we were sort of talking about it as one thing out of the memory drawer of a person. And when I mentioned it and said, maybe this character, his name was Shane, maybe his radical commitment to honesty, availability, sexuality, all of it is rooted in something that wasn't so easy for him. He's at a different place. Joe's not there yet, but he can see Joe. His saying, I love you, is not bullshit. It's like he can see himself, but what was that older self? And we got talking about all kinds of things. And I brought up something in my observed world of this thing, Hawk.
Yeah.
And Olivia literally said, what could be better than that? That's a person who changed his name to Hawk. Mm-hmm. So, she loved it so much that I went and asked him for permission and said, can we actually do this in our film? And he said, yes. I'm using that as an example of, and from that, many things occur. I shared a story about a friend with a passion for carpets, and we realized that's the hook for us. We didn't have the hook for us in the script. Angela has bought the carpet, but Angela and Shane's flirtation was, you know, in fairness, it was like a placeholder. It was indicated at, but the work of going deeper, which Olivia really, when you say, what did she do? She opened up the gateway and just said, let's fill this space with much more to activate it. And so for us, for instance, it's to say, well, but what sparks their connection? What is it? And it was just rug. And then I said, oh, I had this friend who had an erotic passion for rugs. And we realized that's great. So there's another piece comes in, right? And what happens is this accumulation by spending time together and being intimate personally, yes, but in some sense more meditating on the themes of a thing like this, you start to build this like bed of specificity. And when you start to find that, then something really interesting happens, which is she'll say, Angela's going to give Hawk now a tour of an apartment. Now we've got something, which is we've got our anchor, which is they love aesthetic things, and he sees that thing in her and her husband doesn't. And so then Olivia did things like say, I don't even want to script it. Let's walk through the apartment and vibe on each other and riff. And that's probably some of the most improvisatory work I think we've all ever done. There was more improvisation in this film than any film I've ever worked on.
Some of it seems genuine on camera. Because of this whole process, when you both watch the film, can you see more of, you know, yourselves in it than you ordinarily would do in a more conventionally made film where you just come and do the script?
Someone else asked that, but what I don't see is me at all. I see Hawk, but what I see a lot that is very unusual to me is what I know were authentic reactions, like me reacting to something Olivia said unprepared that makes me laugh at her or with her. There's a lot of real surprise, amusement, flirtation. There's a lot going on that wasn't scripted that I loved.
I think for me personally, there definitely is more of me in this than I've ever put into anything. I mean, maybe I did a fully improvised film called Drinking Buddies. It was a mumblecore film that Joe Swanberg directed.
It's
which
a great film.
Well, it's a term they hate, so I almost feel terrible using it. Mumblecore. Which is so it's derogatory. I hate it. They're not mumbling. We didn't mumble. We spoke very clearly. Yeah. but it was, that's sort of how most people know that group. But Joe Swanberg made this film, Drinking Buddies. All we had was an outline. The whole thing was improvised. And that was the first time I, as an actor, felt real authorship of a story. It was the beginning of me thinking maybe I could make a film. And since that, I remember watching that film and feeling very revealed. Like, whoa, that's just me. Mm. And I suddenly was like, is this what they mean when they say like acting is not acting? Acting is just being and whoops. Yeah, now I get it. I've really rarely ever done that. And in this movie, I felt revealed by it in a way that thrilled me because I think that characters like this, for women specifically, are typically forced into a kind of an archetype that is it's pretty like one-dimensional or simplified. There's like the hot mess, or you know, like there's just usually they're not very human. And I felt so lucky to play someone who was like really struggling and flawed, but you know, you see where it's all coming from. So the actor in me is like, oh, I got to pour so much of myself into this role. And I felt really, you know, there was great catharsis in it. And I feel revealed. The director in me, which feels like a totally different person, recognizes that there was no single isolated performance, it really was like a hive mind. It really was this collective expression. We were serving something outside of ourselves.
It pays off so well. We've got to wrap up. I just want to say, I'm assuming none of those early sessions working through it were recorded, but I can see like the 8-hour Peter Jackson version of how this came together. Get Back version of the Invite would be so fascinating as DVD extra, but I'm assuming that was never going to happen.
No, it was not.
It's, you know what?
Unless Seth did it, we don't even know.
It's funny you say that because I had this thing. Now you get into this process and now you're sort of reflecting and you have to have conversations in a short span. And so you do just what we've done here, which is you cherry pick a few examples that illuminate the process, right?
Yeah.
But I was actually thinking about it in the course of all this yesterday. I was like, when I think through those days, it's wild how intensive it is for, it's like running a sustained race or something. You really have to like get it up and keep it up to stay, to make it work. Like the hive mind thing is right. It's almost like if everybody wasn't mentally holding hands, you'd fall off the thing. And it is pretty wild, this one. It's pretty wild what a sustained effort of close collaboration to say, are we on the path together? We think we are. Yes, that worked. What comes next? Yes, that worked. What comes next? To see, can you make it to the end and feel good about it? It was wild.
Yeah.
It was really wild.
It's incredible. I love it so much.
I'm so happy.
Thank you both for talking to me.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, that was Olivia Wilde and Edward Norton talking to Alex Godfrey. I wonder if they extended you an interesting invite, Alex. We'll find out.
Gentleman never tells.
Gentleman never tells. All right, let's talk about the invite then. Jimbo,
yes.
Why don't you set the scene for this more than I already have?
Yes, indeed. This is a rather nice rally for Olivia Wilde, because obviously followed Booksmart with a slightly disappointing Don't Worry, Darling, but this is, as you have said, a very, very good film. It's an English language remake of Cesc Guy's Spanish comedy from 2020, The People Upstairs, which itself was adapted from Guy's stage play, which, Helen, I'm so sorry, I'm going to attempt to say in Spanish, Los Vecinos de Arriba. Sound good?
Los Vecinos de Arriba.
Exactly. That's exactly what I said. So it's been adapted by Rashida Jones and Will McCormack, and it is, exactly as you said, a very theatrical, largely single location story of two couples having dinner that they may or may not want to have. So Seth Rogen plays Joe, who's a music teacher, and Olivia Wilde plays Angela, his wife, and their marriage has, I think fair to say, stagnated. It's kind of collapsed into a sea of resentment and microaggressions, which is somehow exacerbated when Angela, unbeknownst to him, invites the upstairs neighbors, who he doesn't love, over for dinner. This is Pina, played by Penelope Cruz, and Hawk, played by Edward Norton. And they sit down for awkward conversation, canapes, and indeed dinner. And I think fairly safe to say the evening takes some unexpected turns while exploring relationships, sex, philosophy, happiness, middle age, and all of that stuff. This film was shot in 21 days, which is absolutely mad, but I think the idea was to maintain the kind of high pressure, continuous sort of velocity of this, you know, single location type play. And my understanding certainly of it is that it was A, shot sequentially, but they were allowed to heavily improvise the dialogue and inject their own personalities into the character, which I think really comes across as well, which is great. It's so real. Mm. Like, there is a truthfulness to this, which is at once incredible, but also really uncomfortable, because I think you can't help but feel seen in a certain way. Like, it feels like you relate to it in a very awkward, maybe, way that you don't particularly want to. Like, there's a universality to the way it kind of charts the ups and downs of relationship evolution and stagnation, let's be honest. It's very funny. It's occasionally very squirm-inducing. I thought it was very thoughtful. It's really insightful. Also kind of devastating, but with a thread of hope in there as well. So it kind of takes you all over the place. And I think a lot of that is the performances, which I thought were universally great across the board. You know, it is. It's love and it's resentment and it is stagnation and aging. raging and sex and jealousy, malaise, anger, you know, all of that stuff, desire. It kind of covers the whole gamut of it. And I think Seth Rogen is an acquired taste, I think.
Is he?
I think so.
He's great.
He can be great. He can also be, to my mind, deeply irritating. But, and I love him in the studio. And I really love him in this. And I think he plays that character perfectly because he is deeply irritating, as they all are to a greater extent, and deliberately so, because all of those characters wear their flaws on their sleeves. They're very open with who they are. We get to see maybe the worst parts of themselves you wouldn't necessarily want to show to other people. And I think he plays that incredibly well. He's really pissy all the way through the film, and it's very funny. And I think what this kind of does is it shines a light on the kind of the tragedy sometimes of adult relationships and how, you know, Hollywood teaches you that love is one thing, but in reality, love very often isn't that thing. And it goes through a number of different phases. Not all of them are great. And there's a real vulnerability, I think, both to the writing and the performances here. So I really like this. I think it's a very adult comedy. Mm. It's really interesting. I laughed out loud at least three times, and that
you
is almost fucking unheard
loud.
Of.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So, which is wild. It is Olivia Wilde, in fact. Right. It is not a date movie, I would say. But other than that, I thought this was genuinely fantastic.
Yeah,
like, I was unprepared for how good it was, actually.
Yeah, same. I think this is absolutely her on Booksmart form. Yeah. I think it's really well directed as well. It's not just... I mean, it has a terrific screenplay. Will McCormack and Rashida Jones obviously did the adaptation, but it is also just really well directed. Even though it's one location, it doesn't feel static. It doesn't feel stagey. It feels lived in and alive and free. And I just loved it. I wasn't prepared for how much I was going to love it. I'd heard good things. I'd heard good buzz before I went in, but I really wasn't expecting it to be as funny as it is. I didn't used to like Seth Rogen, but now I'm just like all in. I can't remember the last thing he did that I didn't
love. He has aged like a fine wine,
really,
I think, in terms of his output.
He really, really has. Mm. But everybody here, like Edward Norton is not someone really known for his lols, but he's very good
here.
He
brings a lot of the laughs.
He really does.
The one that had me properly barking laughter was one of his.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's so good. And just all of them. There's not a weak link. There's not a weak moment. It's a small film. It's not, you know, it's not epic. It's not going to change the world. It's not for everyone, but I think it's really terrific for what it is. Really, really good.
Yeah. I absolutely loved it. It's a real magic trick, I think, because there's a real looseness to it because it feels so organic and so improvised. And some of it was, but some of it was, you know, the script was written, but then they all spent a couple of weeks together figuring it out and pouring their own experiences into it and improvising and then building that into, I guess, shooting script. But then there were more improvisations on set. And you can really tell when you're watching it that there's a genuine truth. And you don't get this in a lot of films, in a lot of fictional films, especially with actors of this caliber, where you can feel they're actually putting themselves into it. You know, that you can tell that they're working it out together and that there's real thoughts and feelings and opinions going on. And it does really feel quite heated at times.
Oh, God, yeah.
There is an underlying sweetness to it, and there are glimmers of lightness and hope, but it's really, really vicious. And all the bickering in there and all the snappiness at each other is so real. And I can only imagine, you know, apart from the fact that there's also a brilliant screenplay behind it, they worked all this out together and made sure that there was a real genuine authenticity to it. Yeah. And you feel you're watching it and you feel like you're in there. And that's to do with Olivia Wilde's direction and I guess the production design, cinematography as well. However they've staged it, you feel like you're sort of stuck in there with them going through this situation. And what I like best about it is that it is really, really funny. It is an out-and-out comedy, but it's an incredible tonal tightrope they walk because it's exploring some really serious, heavy human things. And it succeeds in doing both of those things at the same time for the whole film. And I was laughing the whole time, and also I felt the whole time a real heaviness to it.
Yeah.
And when I think back to the film, as much as it made me laugh, my takeaway from it is the really meaty, to be honest, quite upsetting stuff.
Yeah.
I was legitimately moved by the last 20 minutes. I did not expect that at all, because the first, I don't know how long this movie is, about 105, something like that. So the first 80 minutes is just hilarious. And I'm really surprised, Jimbo, you connected with this, because it's cringe comedy of the highest order.
It is, but it's weirdly, it's not the particular flavor of cringe comedy that really, really just reduces me to a puddle on the floor. And I wonder whether it's just like the pathos is so tangible. And I think
it
is very witty, and I really do appreciate the writing in this, but I think anyone who's been in a long-term relationship will see that very particular excruciating mix of affection and just weaponized passive aggression. And it's just like, it hits quite close to home.
And sometimes just straight out aggression.
Right, yeah. Absolutely. And just how someone can be, because Seth Rogen, and he's not afraid to just be like, just a massive cock all the way through, which I appreciate that. And you still feel for him.
Yeah, I don't think the movie takes sides with anyone at all. Everyone's sympathetic to a degree. Everyone's a dickhead to a degree.
That's why it works.
Really, really. Like, it's terrific. I mean, it's come out in the summer, but I've already seen some people say that it could be an Oscar contender. And there's a moment where Edward Norton has a speech towards the end, which I think I was just like, oh, okay, that's supporting actor nomination locked in, I think, for that one. But Seth Rogen's amazing in it. Penelope Cruz is amazing in it. Olivia Wilde, who's wearing two hats in this movie, is exceptional doing both. And I will caveat this with, I haven't seen Obsession yet. I still haven't seen Obsession yet. I keep meaning to, but the World Cup keeps getting in the way. That's my obsession at the moment. This is my film of the year so far. I was levitating out of the cinema afterwards. It really did a number on me.
Top five for me. Top three, maybe.
There you go.
Definitely top five.
Yeah. Ellen and James both agree with me. Their favorite film of the year so far. That's what I heard. So we give this 4. Alex,
that was me. Yeah. I gave it 4. And there have been people who ask me why I didn't give it 5. And it's because... I would say it's up there. It's nearly. I don't think it's a flat out 100% masterpiece, but it's not far off. I mean, I have to see it again, and probably will see it again.
It's a good job it doesn't compare, you know, in an odd way to another film that we're reviewing this week that got 5 stars. So that's good.
And the film which James is referring to is Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie. Alex.
This is a brilliant film. This is a 5-star film. And if I were reviewing it, I would also have given it 5 stars because it's a piece of genius. James, it's not for you.
That much is true.
So thank you for your contribution. I don't have to say anything else. This is directed by Matt Johnson, who is incredible. He's a one-of-a-kind director. He's a gonzo director. He's pure chaos energy on screen, off screen, both here. He came out the gate, I think, in 2008 with a film called The Dirties, which was an astonishing take on school shootings. And he came out of nowhere. He more recently did Blackberry, which was a film that no one expected. And again, that was a very anarchic film. Cameras, the cast didn't quite know where they were. You know, it felt like it was all on the fly, but it was unexpectedly emotional. He's just an anarchic guy making anarchic films, and he's done that again here to the max. So yes, this is him and his, like, I think, genuine best friend, Jay McCarroll. They've been buddies forever. They've been doing this sort of skit, as it were, for a good 20 years or so. They play two musicians in a band called Nirvana. The band, that's a joke. It's nothing to do with Nirvana, the actual band.
There's three N's in Nirvana instead of two.
I think it didn't start off like that, but later on, for legal reasons, they were told maybe you should do that. They did a couple of web series 15, 20 years ago. Then they did a series for Vice on TV. And now they've made this movie, and it's an absolute meta masterpiece. It's ostensibly, it's about these couple of musicians, Matt and Jay, playing Matt and Jay in Toronto. It's a very, very Toronto film.
So Toronto.
All they want to do is play a gig at this venue, the Rivoli, which is not Wembley Stadium. That's their whole mission in life. I think that's been the foundation of everything they've done before on TV, and as it is again in this film. But this one takes that idea to epic proportions, and I don't want to give it away. As fun as it would be to discuss it, let's just say it riffs on some very big things on pop culture, and it evolves time travel in the most low-rent, ingenious, gonzo way. And what's outstanding about it is that when they did this web series 20 years ago, they filmed themselves for hundreds of hours, literally. And because there's a time travel conceit involved here, they use a lot of that footage. And their editors, who they always work with, went through all this footage and said, oh, we've got this, maybe you could do this. And they were feeding ideas to them, and they built a plot around it. And I watched this whole film, I thought the whole thing was gobsmacking. It's really funny. It's really, really clever. It is genuinely quite stirring, because I think it's a, at the end of the day, forget everything else I just talked about, it's a brilliant film about male friendship, or certainly this male friendship, and about the ups and downs they have and the little petty jealousies and resentments they have each other and the bromance and the love they have for each other. And it's put together amazingly. It's a pretty simple bromance friendship drama, but the way it's done is like nothing else you've seen. I think it's genuinely startling. There was one scene which is so shocking and so funny at the same time. When it happened, James, your eyebrows have been raised for 3 minutes. You can just put it down.
He's doing, as people said on our Empire Plus photographs, he's doing DreamWorks animation face. Yeah. And he is. Oh, by the way, we changed the artwork for one of those things already.
We have. We've changed the logos.
Because I took a look at our the podcast feed, and it was just, there was too much of us. Too much of us. Yeah. So we've changed it. Anyway, please,
well,
Alex.
I'm getting that live in the flesh, and it's quite upsetting. But anyway, I just think everything that this film is trying to do, regardless of whether James likes it or not, I don't think there's 1% of this film that doesn't work.
Yeah.
I don't think there's 1 second of it that doesn't work gangbusters in terms of what they were intending for it. I think it's really distinctive. I think it's really funny. I think it's quite emotional. And I had such an exciting time. It's pure energy. And you won't see anything else like it.
It's a really, really beautiful film about friendship. And it's also fucking hilarious. And I think the contrast of their low rent aspirations to play in this, it looks moderately sized club, right? It looks like the Limelight in Belfast or something. I don't know how to put that in London terms because I don't go to enough gigs. It looks just small. And this is the height of their ambitions for 17 years has been to play this one club. And then they go to these extraordinary, wild, deeply stupid, completely sci-fi lengths to do so. And I just think that's beautiful. In the same way that I love the mad portrayal of male friendship in the Jackass movies, I love the mad portrayal of male friendship in this movie because it's about as realistic, but it's so, so heartwarming and charming and sweet.
A lot of it is realistic. I mean, a lot of it is actually real. I mean, these are two guys going out on the streets of Toronto doing mad shit for real and just capturing it on camera.
Well, it's part Jackass, part Borat, isn't it? Part Bill and Ted. Like, it's all of those things together. But, like,
you're just making it sound better.
Yeah, but, like, but not as good as any of those things.
That's
because
untrue.
It doesn't have any of the gross-out madness that Jackass has. It's nowhere near
good.
As clever or thoughtful as Borat. And it's not
untrue.
Funny as fucking Bill and Ted.
Untrue.
I found Matt Johnson supernaturally irritating. This film drove me fucking mad. I found the one joke that they flogged to death over the course of the film's runtime to be deeply, deeply annoying. And I don't know, it really, really tried my patience. And all the way through this, I was thinking, this is a Ben Travis special. He must be stopped. I'm going to make my own time machine. I'm going to go back in time and I'm going to make him stop. But it turns out, I need to kill you two as well. This is very,
I
very
love
upsetting
Matt Johnson,
to me.
And I think if he heard this now, he would find it.
He'd probably appreciate
love
it.
Your
if he knew my relationship with comedy, he'd probably be like, yes, I have succeeded. And that may well be true.
This film is clearly not designed to appeal to everyone. This is not a tentpole movie.
No, it's not. I think it's one of these things as well, because it has a very specific note that it hits. So it's kind of repetitive in the extent that it knows what it's good at and it does it. And if you're not on board with that, which I very much am not, then it's just irritating over the runtime. And I just couldn't get there because I was like, you know, because obviously they are deliberately barely a band. The show was hardly a show, and this is only just a movie. Like, it's just, yeah, it's very much not for me.
It's not only just a movie. It's an exquisite piece
it's
of work.
It's a great
movie. Honestly, it's like I'm taking crazy pills.
5 stars then for Nirvana, the band,
yay!
The show, the movie. I haven't seen it yet, but James...
You'll love it.
Yeah, but yeah, that's a recommendation. If James hates a comedy this viscerally,
it's a comedy. I hate it. You might love it.
It sounds like an absolute belter. All right, 5 stars then for that movie. And what about another comedy? I'm very, very much looking forward to Minions and Monsters, Hell's Bells.
Hello. Yes, this is the new Pierre Coffin Minions installment.
Peter Coffin.
If you must. It's got a weird framing device, which is Alison Janney as a museum guide taking a bunch of humans around a museum of movie stuff.
Right.
And it's filled with lots of Universal things and other stuff. And they come to the statue of two minions, and she explains that these two were pivotal in movie history. And everyone's like, huh? And so she tells them the story of James and Henry, the two minions at the heart of this movie. And we learn about their past serving, for example, a Cyclops and a wicked warlock and stealing his book. And then they end up in kind of early Hollywood. Now, it does have the minions then going through a whole bunch of like silent movie tropes and early Hollywood stars and encounters. And that is a lot of fun. And then we get into the and monsters part of the title, which involves them, you know, basically summoning up a baby Cthulhu and getting into some trouble at that point.
Right.
So I was having a really good time with the first half of this movie, which was the old Hollywood stuff, even as I sat there and went, well, women's suffrage was well settled before sound came in. Ugh. And things like that, because there is a women's suffragette character who's voiced by Zoe Deutsch, for example, who falls in love with a guy in a robot suit voiced by Jesse Eisenberg. It's a whole thing. But I, you know, so I was really there for all the Hollywood stuff, and then I didn't care at all about the monster stuff, and I have no interest whatsoever in minions' feelings. That makes me sound like a supervillain. I hope James appreciated that.
I do.
Thank you.
Great.
But I don't care about their feelings. And anytime these films try to be sincere, I'm a bit like, oh, bored now.
Which boring.
Is probably what my small niece and nephew will also be thinking. But the chaos stuff in this film is very fun. And the Hollywood, the old Hollywood stuff is very fun. Chris, this might be the thing that finally gets you to like Charlie Chaplin. I don't know.
No.
It could happen.
No, that's not possible.
So I had real fun with the Hollywood bits and no fun at all with the monster bits. But, you know, you already know if you're going to go see this film. If you have children under 10, you're probably already booked to see this film. And they will have fun and they may get into some conversations with you and you may want to have, at the very least, clips of Safety Last and Modern Times.
No, not Modern Times. Just Safety Last.
Well, I'm just saying.
No chat.
On the computer when you get home. But it, you know, so it might get some interesting conversation started with kids, and I really hope it does. But it's also just fun in its own right for its audience. But I just you know, we don't need sincerity from minions. I will also say, of course, that I think this is probably, and I think I'm clear in saying this, this is Universal's very best movie this month to feature a Cyclops. I don't think there's going to be any question on that score whatsoever.
In fact, the only movie, one. Right? I don't think it's going to be another one.
I can't imagine there's another one. Yeah. So yeah, this should really have that title sewn up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Fantastic. Alex, very, very quickly on this one.
I completely agree. Actually, the first 30 or 40 minutes of this film, I was laughing so much. I loved what they did with history. The Buster Keaton, Harold Lloyd, the Citizen Kane. I mean, it was done so cleverly. It was done with genuine passion, I think, as well. You can tell that Pierre Coffin loves this stuff. He's a real old school cinephile. And for the first 30, 40 minutes, I thought this is the most insane thing I've ever seen. And also it was done so beautifully with the choreography. It was hilarious. Again, I sort of, it wore thin for me, all the monster stuff. That actually felt like more of a conventional one of these
really.
Sort of films.
Yeah, really boring.
The only thing I would say for that thing, it was okay, but Trey Parker is very good value as Gumi, megalomaniac little Cthulhu squid person. A film very much of two halves, but the first half is absolutely joyous.
All right, what do we give it?
3 stars.
Three, oh, wow. Who reviewed this?
John Nugent.
Oh, bring him to me. In fact, he's coming here right now to do a Toy Story 5 spoiler special. Everything is proceeding as I have foreseen. Of course, I can't get angry about it. I haven't seen the film, but that just feels mean-spirited. What did the minions ever do to John Nugent? That's what I want to know.
Well, tried to, you know, accidentally cause the destruction of the Earth, for example, a couple of times.
Ah, that's fine. Bygones. 3 stars anyway, Len, for Minions and Monsters. And real quick, Enola Holmes 3 opened this week as well on Netflix. Millie Bobby Brown back, of course, as Sherlock Holmes's younger, smarter sister. Henry Cavill in it briefly, because Sherlock Holmes gets kidnapped.
Yes. And
in this, Himesh Patel is Dr. Watson. There's all sorts of stuff going on. It's filmed in Malta, but they don't mention it every 5 minutes. directed by Philip Barantini, who directed Boiling Point and Adolescence. And this is just as hard-hitting and gritty, I would say. Wouldn't you say Hellspells?
Yeah, it's. I'm not sure those are the words I'd apply, but look, if you like Enola Holmes, this is more of that. She's on her way to get married to her long-term squeeze, played by Lewis Partridge, when Himesh Patel's Dr. Watson tells her that her brother's been kidnapped, and then she, of course, has to swing into action.
Oh my God, I've got to swing into action.
Rescue him instead. But that's all to the good because she's already having, you know, angst about being a lady. She's going to be a lady if she marries him. So it allows her to work out all her issues as well.
While looking at the camera a lot.
A lot.
A lot.
A lot of chatting to the camera.
A lot of breaking the fourth wall.
Exactly, and figuring stuff out. Look, it's fun and silly, and I wonder if I'm going to remember anything about the plot in a week. But as these films go, it's pacey. You know, she's good in the role. It's a great cast around her. I don't want to mention all the people who are coming back because, spoiler, but like, they're
surprises.
All back.
Surprises, big they're surprises. Oh, I can't believe that person's back.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. I was less surprised, perhaps. But
big shock when that person showed up. You know the one I'm talking about.
I know the one.
Yeah.
Well, it could be one or two.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Or four. It's really hard to tell. But I just, I'm glad to see the Enola Holmes mythology just deepening and getting richer with every outing.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
I don't think.
Okay.
Okay. But, you
what
know,
do we give it?
Three stars.
Three stars.
The definition of a three-star film. Like, it's fine. It's okay. It's like, I think, half an hour shorter than Enola Holmes 2, but feels half an hour longer, which is an interesting one.
That's because I keep mentioning Malta every time.
I mean, there is that. It does feel a little bit like it's paid for by the Maltese Tourist Board, but it's really convoluted. Like, really convoluted. There is, like, it talks about there's kidnapping, there's murder, there's larceny, there's, you know, the shadow of British colonialism. There's kind of a lot going on, and it's occasionally hard to follow. Because these are odd, because they're not kids' movies. They're not really adult movies. They seem to occupy this kind of early teen space.
YA?
I think, in terms of tone. Yeah, very much a kind of YA thing, but I think at the younger end of the YA spectrum.
Geordies will love it.
YA? YA man. Christ. Yeah, anyway, three stars in Enola Holmes 3.
Three stars then for Enola Holmes, the band, the show, the movie. Very, very exciting.
Significantly funnier than that.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Get and out.
On that note, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, where we'll be joined by... Well, next week sees the release of Evil Dead Burn, the latest movie in the Evil Dead franchise. And we'll be joined by that film's stars, Suela Yacoub. And I will spend the next week learning how to actually pronounce her name. I apologize if I didn't get it right. And Hunter Doohan. And I will also spend the next week learning how to pronounce his name as well. That is an extremely gory film, by the way, folks. I don't think I'm breaking embargo to tell you that. But anyway, until then, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from my three colleagues of such lethal cunning. Goodbye, James Dyer.
Goodbye, Chris Hewitt.
Goodbye, Alex Godfrey. Off to do Edward Norton and Olivia Wilde.
As it were.
As it were.
Right.
It's goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to lock James in a frozen cave so he can get up to no mischief from now on.
With Nirvana, the band. On loop forever.
Playing on a loop forever until you're 90.
Empire, the show, the twats, the podcast.
Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.